You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of December 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Lo abbiamo fatto in modo molto rapido.
We did it very quickly. This was not caused by impatience, but because I believe it is clear to everyone the importance of giving to Italy stable institutions and certainty in the current circumstances.
Italy has a new Prime Minister, but is there much point in him unpacking? My guests Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the apparently ongoing evacuation of the final rebel redoubts in Aleppo, the possibility that Donald Trump was elected president by a typographical error, and Justin Trudeau's ongoing discovery that politics isn't as easy as he was making it look. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Robert Fox, defence editor of the Evening Standard, and Michael Goldfarb, the journalist, author and broadcaster. Welcome both. Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, has all but declared victory in Aleppo, making a televised announcement to the effect that history is being made and describing what is happening to the city as a liberation, terminology that may be disputed by certain of its surviving residents. Evacuations of fighters and civilians alike from the remaining rebel-held areas appear to be underway. Both Russia and Syria have issued guarantees of their safety. Michael, first of all, how keen would you be to bet your own life on those guarantees?
Well, I suppose if I was a school teacher who had just not got out in time and was caught between the rock of rebel fighters, some of whom are, you know, connected to what used to be Jabhat al-Nusra, and the hard place of the Syrian regime, and with the full backing of the Russian military, I might take my chances going in a green van. On the other hand, I suppose any able-bodied man in particular, over the age of about 14, is really taking a big gamble on good wishes that have yet to really be manifest for any considerable length of time. So it's a very, very difficult thing. But if you've got kids and they're saying you can go and they have stopped bombing for an hour or two, I think you have to go. I don't think there's any choice. If you're inclined to think, you know, freedom or death, you might just hang around and try and take a few people with you before you go.
Robert, is this now effectively victory in the Syrian civil war for Bashar al-Assad? He now effectively more or less controls everything along the M5 motorway, which is the backbone of Syria. You know, it's the road that links Aleppo to Hama to Homs to Damascus. Has he all but won this now?
No, because it's not Syria. It's a very important part of Syria, as you say, because the conflict in Syria, as it has in Iraq, is atomized. Just think why these so-called ceasefires or amnesties to get the civilians out and then some of the fighters from eastern Aleppo broke down. They broke down because diverse elements of the Syrian forces and the Iranian militias wanted sieges lifted on surrounding towns and hamlets to the east. Yes, you can get Alawistan out of this, but I don't think, I'm much more pessimistic and hardline as my readers would have been following all week about this, because Assad doesn't have the forces to do it. Think of things. There are things that the correspondents should be writing about, but they're not. Things like track mileage of a tank, of a personnel carrier, they are finite. These things are going to break down. And what is breaking down with the Assad forces is not only the hardware. Leave aside arms and ammunition, the amount of ammunition that's being pooped away across the Middle East. Where is it all coming from? It will come in, but it's going to be a huge burden for Russia, incidentally, and also personnel. Yes, they have made the desert and called it peace, to quote Tacitus, as the head of Britain's MI6 had said. But actually, It's a distorted piece, which actually in the original Tacitus Agricola, that actually was not an essay about that. It was about the distortion of language. And that is also a message for what we're getting from Assad and from Putin, because it ain't over until it's all over. What Russia has got itself into is a new form of hybrid warfare, which they thought that they had invented in Ukraine, but it's not on their own terms in the Middle East.
I just want to pick Robert up when you first said, that there is no Syria. And I've had arguments with people, with Syrians, in fact, whom I'm friendly with in the modern way on social networks, who are in exile. And it's hard for people to acknowledge that the country in which they were born grew up. It is not possible to imagine that there will be Syria at the end of whatever, if they had finally come to some agreement and they stopped fighting, there is no Syria. There is no possibility that the global community will find the hundreds of billions of dollars to rebuild the wreckage. They have indeed, I think Alawistan, Assad is from the Alawi sect, is about right. And, you know, one only has to look at Afghanistan. After the Russians went in the 1980s and were thrown out, or actually they went in the late 70s, they're thrown out in the 80s and early 90s, and look at Afghanistan today. There's still no way to make it function. And Afghanistan is a small place with not much connection to the rest of the world.
Afghanistan's still a more or less unitary state, though, in that the external borders have not shifted.
Ooh, sorry. No, but remember, you have the Durand Line, which has always been permeable, porous, and unrecognized.
Mm. True enough.
And what Michael is saying, sorry, this is going to be a bit of a love fest, because I absolutely agree. We have to really describe to ourselves what contemporary, not only Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, and Sudan really are. They are not unitary states.
They aren't.
As their membership, whether they have it or not, with the UN would conceive it to be. It is not going to happen like that.
And particularly, again, coming back to Robert, this is a love fest. But, you know, when Robert spoke about what correspondents should be doing, first of all, we all know the reason that there aren't enough correspondents. We've never had a full picture on this war because we haven't been allowed to report it, and there aren't that many correspondents left on newspaper staff and on broadcaster.
But I think the big reason for it is that it is just far too dangerous.
And
it has been quite deliberately made far too dangerous.
And also, Andrew, there are very good writers, and some of them are getting in, but it is so complex now with the cyber dimension and social media, etc., that it is very difficult to grasp the whole. But what I think Michael and I are both driving, synthesis, is there has been a tipping point. There is a huge change post the end of history, the sort of consensus with the end of the Cold War, that we are into a new phase, which it's a very impoverished term, but the term is continuous conflict. I agree with Michael entirely. Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Sudan, Somalia, and I could name a few more, are condemned generationally to continuous conflict.
Okay, well, let's move along on that cheerful thought to a slightly less chaotic polity. This is Italy, which has now had a new prime minister for nearly 24 hours. And for much of the 20th century, this would normally be the point at which the holder of the office started clearing his desk for the next guy. But things have lately been somewhat more stable. But after the somewhat self-inflicted demise of Matteo Renzi, he has been replaced by former Foreign Minister Paolo Gentiloni, whose appointment was approved by Parliament yesterday. Some have now wondered whether it might be time once again to refit the Palazzo Chigi with a revolving door. Robert, first of all, has Renzi actually quit? He quit after losing the reform on, or his referendum on constitutional reform. He remains the leader of his party. The new prime minister will be keeping most of Renzi's cabinet. There will probably be elections next year. Is this guy just warming the seat?
Marco, the question is, and it's not actually down to Gentiloni or to Renzi, but it's down to the very, very interesting president, Sergio Mattarella, whether they have elections this coming up spring or in 2018. He has got to produce stability, Gentiloni, and it's part of the pact. Why Renzi is still a presence is that he is going to fight the election, and he is going to fight the general election, whether it's in March next year or the year after, on the case of you don't quit when you still can get something out of it. And by that, I mean the EU. If he's going to pledge Italy's commitment to the EU, Italy's destiny is with the EU. But what he will want to do, which is very interesting for what's going on in France and Germany, he will insist on acceleration, the acceleration of integration. And it is really, I was about to use a very rude word, something or bust, because this is the question about the Italian political crisis, which is, yes, you can do the stamp collecting number. This is the 65th administration since the Constitution of the Republic of 1948, the 70 years since then. But it is a real make or break, because for once, and it's amazing how slow the European partners are to wake up to this, this could be make or break for the EMU, the euro, and probably the EU itself.
Michael, Italy also faces, as many European countries do, or have, a species of populist insurrection, though so far as it's possible to characterise Five Star, it seems slightly more leftish inclined than rightish inclined. Given that Mr. Gentiloni is pretty much a paragon of your wealthy establishment titled aristocrat, is he really the right person to let the air out of that?
I don't know that much about Italian politics. What I do know is that, Robert alluded to it a moment ago, it's normative to have governments falling almost every 18 months, 24 months. So that the revolving door that you spoke of earlier, Andrew, actually is a revolving door, because it is so normal that the leaders of a party, the main thing is they have to keep being leaders of their party, because the party falls out after 2 years, and then 2 years later, gets swept back in. So I don't know. I mean, I think that it would be... I think what interests me about Beppe Grillo and his five-star movement is, and I suppose to a certain degree, Podemos. Although Podemos has actually won some positions in the municipality in Madrid, I guess it is. It would be very interesting to see what happened to him if he really was getting close to power and actually had to make decisions. Because I don't know then if the mind would be concentrated.
It doesn't depend on Grillo, who I kind of know was a colleague of mine. Very, very smart, funny man, but too funny at the moment. I thought he was going back to the stage. He has resurrected himself. The two crucial figures are two lady mayors, if I can grace them with that. Virginia Raggi of Rome, who has not been terribly successful, but the much more successful and younger at 32, Chiara Appendino. Read Chiara Appendino's manifesto. She is in Turin. She beat a very well-established politician, a former foreign minister, to take that position. Earlier this year. Right. Now, I think it is actually down to the crew, and they're generally lawyers, and some of their manifestos are extremely interesting and articulate as to what happens to the Five Star Movement. For the caricature of the Five Star Movement in the Anglo-Saxon press is pure fiction, because they go, and even the BBC, sorry to take a great name in vain, and they go and hear Beppe doing his number. And he's hilarious.
There's an assumption it's basically Russell Brand gone slightly
wild,
hasn't it?
It is not. And it's how they're manoeuvring, and it taps into two roots. Marxist radicalism, but also think Red Brigades, and I'm not accusing them of that, but the Red Brigades route was not so much Marxism, but radical Catholicism. And a figure like Appendino, and that is why I think, and she's been very clever in the way that she's played it, is a much more important figure, and she's as important as Cypress, I would say. And I am watching how that group would manoeuvre. They're a new age group, and she and Raggi have a newish message, because they say, Italians, we know we're getting terribly old as Italians. We know we have hellish problems like migration, because they don't know how many people are coming across the Mediterranean to them. And we've got to address this. And by the way, we have known that the infrastructure, actual and fiscal, has been crumbling for years and years and years. And why they're so important, they ask the questions of Brussels and of the ECB. They ask for help. We need to go into special measures. And what have they all said? No, 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 no. And I think it's Italy, almost more than the Dutch elections or the French elections and much later the German elections, that is going to ask the really big question, is the EU viable next year?
Well, I'm going to have to go back to Turin, which I discovered this summer, and it is now my official favorite city in Italy. It's wonderful.
It's a very interesting city, too. Yeah.
I have never been to Turin, but I find that an extraordinary suggestion, given that I have many favourite cities in Italy.
Why things are not so happy there? Torino really was Fiat City for a long time. The Agnelli family really made it with building up Fiat, and they had La Stampa and so on. And what has happened this year? It did make, briefly, the front page of the Financial Times. Fiat has moved out of Italy, out of Turin, because it so has lost confidence in institutions. And the Fiat headquarters is now in Rotterdam.
Okay, well, on that unsolicited plug for the city of Turin, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, does American democracy need to be switched off, then switched back on again?
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb. Now, adherents of the chaos or cock-up theory of history will require no persuasion that apparently insignificant events can have inadvertently seismic consequences, arguably the more so in an ever more interlinked world. At which point, we need to confront the possibility that the worst unimprisoned man in America got elected president because someone made a typo in a message to their IT guy. An exciting new theory posits that a Democratic Party aide vouched a phishing email from Russian spooks as legitimate when he meant the opposite, which allowed access to the Gmail account of Hillary Clinton campaign chief John Podesta. Michael, how unlikely or otherwise does this sound? I mean, I have ceased disbelieving pretty much anything at this point in 2016. I have no trouble buying this.
No, that's because everybody's had a phishing email and had that moment of hesitation where you think, do I open this? It looks semi-legit, but do I know the... And then sent it to the spam folder. And you can see there's an exceptional plausibility to, you know, some lowly person who's got 1,000 emails a day to go through, just saying, yeah, it's fine, and pushing it along. And then suddenly they're in, and apparently this is... the story in the New York Times goes on and on to say that this is... Essentially, they weren't hacking servers. They were simply sending out a gazillion emails,
which is the way that phishing works. You send out a gazillion emails on the assumption that due to gullibility or ineptitude, somebody will click the wrong
it's
thing.
Like a cold call.
And then you are in. And I think that the whole thing, it has two levels here. I don't think that John Podesta's emails made a blind bit of difference to the outcome. The outcome, I mean, Hillary Clinton got about 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. And in the critical rural counties of Michigan and Wisconsin, where she unexpectedly didn't poll as well as Barack Obama, and Obama voters, white voters, by the way, went over and voted for Trump. That seems to me to be the key to how he managed to swing those states in the Electoral College. But on the other hand, I mean, the thing about this that we can all have a laugh about, but really, I think it's the sheer ballsiness and blatant nature of this whole thing with Russian hackers trying to get in and then without... I mean, in the old days of cloak and dagger, you weren't supposed to know when spying was going on. This is almost like rubbing America's nose in it. And I think that, to me, is what's both funny and also very dangerous and concerning.
Robert, to ask the question, I guess, in the reverse-engineered way, wouldn't it be completely astonishing to have discovered that Russia wasn't trying to hack the email accounts of senior American officials?
In today's terms, absolutely, you're right. I mean, why are we so naive about this? This thing goes on. As I said, we get about 3, 4, 5 cold calls a day.
My wife, well, this is what I keep thinking.
Was raging at me. I said, because one sucker is going to fall for
this
it.
This is what I keep thinking. If people are trying to hack my emails, and, you know, speaking as somebody who commands relatively little influence, then...
No, and it's bound to happen. But I do like the idea that, that Trump is the beneficiary of an electronic butterfly's wing flapping in Tokyo and the snowstorm comes down in, according to my friend Michael here, rural Iowa, and the hog farmers vote for
Trump. I never got that, because at any given moment, there's probably 30 billion butterflies flapping their wings. So how do you know which one is causing the chaos?
That's right. No, it's the one which has the black swan.
Come for me. We are deviating at this point into a horrifically mixed metaphor. But Michael, how do we get a sense yet of how big a deal this could become? Because we now had Senator Lindsey Graham, a fairly senior, fairly serious Republican figure, putting his hand up saying, well, they tried to hack mine. Does this get to a point where if there is enough of this stuff, it does start to undermine Trump's legitimacy?
Well, I mean, I can say... Might as well. It's been a month. I might as well venture into the world of prediction again. I think that the legitimacy of Donald Trump is always going to be a 46.3% proposition. That is the 46.3% of the American electorate who could be bothered to vote, who voted for him. So in that respect, I don't think that that's a question. I do think what it does, again, I come back to my point about how blatant it is. And I think this should really... It should put a scare under, and I'm sure that's why Lindsey Graham went public today and said that, you know, I was hacked as well. Graham is a senior Republican in the Senate. The Senate is in the hands of the Republicans. The House of Representatives is in the hands of the Republicans. 32 out of 50 state governorships are in the hands of Republicans. The Republicans will form the next opposition in America. And essentially what he's saying is, look, we have a re-energized and formidable opponent globally in Russia. And this is what they're doing. They're not even trying to hide it. And we need to take steps to stop it and to let them know that they cannot behave in this manner with impunity and that there has to be punishment. And in fact, when he made the announcement, we have to have more sanctions. And of course, Trump has just appointed a Secretary of State.
A recipient of the Order of Friendship of Russia. The same medal, as I was delighted to discover yesterday, has previously been presented to George Blake.
It does undermine him. Yeah, because it undermines not his legitimacy so much, but his credibility. And there is that dreadful line about populism in the American electoral system of H.L. Mencken. If you go on with this, you know, this populist approach, he said, you end up with a moron in the White House. I'm not saying, you know, but that's
you
where we are.
You paraphrase him slightly, but that is the sentiment.
That is the sentiment. And if Trump is not seen to be effective this time next year with the constituency that Michael has outlined, the steel worker that's lost its job, the coal miner in the Appalachians, and the hog farmer in Iowa, I think that he is in trouble. By populism you shall live, but by populism you shall die as well.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should look to Canada and ask the question, is the Justin Trudeau honeymoon over? Having earned a chorus of derision globally for his emetic encomium to overstaying Cuban tyrant Fidel Castro, he now faces some uncomfortable headlines at home. Canada's Canada's Ethics Commissioner, Mary Dawson, intends to question the Prime Minister formally over conflicts of interest pertaining to his attendance at Liberal Party fundraisers where other guests included favour-seeking corporate donors. Michael, first of all, this isn't a good look, obviously, getting questioned by an Ethics Commissioner. But isn't all political fundraising a conflict of interest? I mean, as soon as you turn up, start shaking the hands of people whose money you want.
Well, I comb through the news coming out of Canada, which I don't do every day, I confess. Tyler, forgive me. The Toronto Globe and Mail has an article, which explains all what you've just outlined, Andrew, but didn't get at an allegation that seemed to jump out at me as a lead paragraph, or even, as we say in American journalism, the nut graph. What was it that was being exchanged? Because so long as there's money in politics, so long as you have to go to fundraisers to keep your party alive so they can, pay their workers who call you on the phone at dinner time to say, will you vote for Justin Trudeau? I don't know how you avoid this. So there needs to be more meat here. What the allegation is, and I just haven't seen that yet, but does it take the shine off? It's never a good look, as you say.
Robert, does this kind of stuff actually matter so long as we know who has paid what to whom?
No, I don't think so necessarily. One thing that struck me about this thing, and I read the account of Mary Dawson's allegation, she's not exactly unparty pre, belonging to the opposing side in a previous incarnation. Justin Trudeau was pretty good in fessing up to it. He said, yes, I was there. He didn't try to deny. He said, yes, money was raised. And it's exactly Michael's point. They are fiendishly difficult things to do. Look at the ludicrous sums of money that were raised, particularly by Hillary Clinton and the foundation and so on, and the whole, which still has a bit of a whiff about it, in the American campaign. Party finance in the UK is absolutely horrible as well. What do you do? Do you tell parties to get on and raise their own funds, or do you have a state subsidy for them?
Well, Prime Minister doesn't even have knighthoods he can sell people.
Yeah, but the idea, do you divvy it up and you pay electoral expenses, which they do bits of. And even that's not very pleasant either. It's a horrible, horrible world. And there's no real smoking gun as yet in the Trudeau story, because he said, yes, I was there. Yes, we raised money. Yes, they do raise money for access. What do you want now? Come at me.
it's funny. I'm just thinking. Yesterday, Donald Trump gathered the great titans of Silicon Valley round a conference table in his Manhattan area in the Trump Tower. And somebody managed to get the seating plan out. And it's sort of like you can tell who's who in Silicon Valley and on his team by who was there. And of course, sat at the left hand, not the right hand of God, but Vice President Pence was at the right hand of God. But on the left hand of God was Peter Thiel, the venture capitalist, who very publicly gave $1 million to Donald Trump to run for office. So now here he has all of the other titans. I mean, just beyond Peter Thiel is Tim Cook, and on the other side going the other way was, Larry Page from Google. But you think, what will $1 million get you? It gets you to the top floor of the Trump Tower, and you sit at the left hand of the president. He put his hands on him, literally. I mean, laying on him, said, I want to thank you. Peter saw something before you guys saw something. This is what he said. This was tweeted out. And you think, wow, that, yes, money talks and bullshit walks is the American motto for sure.
Well, on that happy and uplifting thought, Michael Goldfarb and Robert Fox, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Daphne Carnesis. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and there's more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.